Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Opera Now. I'm your host, Michael Rice. Good to be back with you all. I apologize that we weren't on last week, but I had a little hard drive problem. Hard drive failed, and I lost the show that we had recorded. It was a good show, some good stuff, but in hindsight, maybe it's for the best that it did fail, because we've obviously had some big news this week, and I didn't want to get caught with my pants down the same way I was with Beverly Sills. So, with, you know, erratum and addendums and crap like that. So I thought I'd start with a new, fresh show for you all. Coming on tonight is my man, B-Mac.
Hi, guys.
Oliver Camacho.
Thanks for listening.
And the dripping wet, fresh from the bath, Aaron Smith.
Hello. Am I the first girl that y'all have had on this little panel?
No.
No, I am.
But I'm the first dripping wet girl.
Probably.
Oh, gross. Yeah.
No, okay. We've had women on the show before.
Oh, okay.
So.
I got to catch up with all of these.
You do. Some
we're still
not,
really
some may not be on again, but we'll have others to replace. Okay. So let's jump into the first topic. We've got obviously one major looming thing, but there's a couple interesting stories that I saw and that others have seen and sent to me. This is from the New York Times. Operatic acting, oxymoron no more. This is from the New York Times. The tenor lifts sausage arms skyward, ignoring the soprano as he ardently professes his love to the grand tier. She looks on with a distracted smile, the slight tension in her eyes suggesting not swelling emotion, but determination to nail the top note a few bars away. Note secured, applause graciously accepted, her fatal swoon has all the pliant delicacy of a redwood succumbing to a chainsaw. Bad opera acting of a cliché can certainly still be found in some outposts of the opera world, even betimes in New York. But most regular opera-goers would probably agree the standards have been rising impressively in recent years. Okay, this is something we've talked about, of course, many, many times, but this is... It's a timely subject and a timely timely story. So
the New York Times has finally caught on to our podcast, it sounds
they
like.
They have. They've been nicking our topics.
Well, they finally caught on to something. I mean, what? I wonder what the timing of this story had to do with, you know, I mean, this doesn't strike me as news.
No.
You know, they just need to fill some space, so they, you know.
Well, which sausage tenor are they talking about, anyway?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and what sausage?
Probably Melchior.
What provoked the article is what I'm wondering.
Well, a lot of it is talking about the production of Lucia with Natalie Dessay and Mary Zimmerman, who is directing it.
Right.
And you know, a lot of this probably is, you know, Gelb's second year, starting up now, and he's obviously had some pretty strong opinions about what he expects and what he wants to see on the stage of the Met. So, and apparently Charles Isherwood thought it was a timely story. So, and it's kind of it is something we've hashed over and over again, but, you know, acting versus singing and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. But, I don't know. Does anybody have any ideas, any opinions?
Yeah, I will say that, because I live in this small town called Chicago, I got to see Natalie Dessay actually premiere Lucia di Lammermoor. She did it here, just the way they do Broadway shows here in Chicago before they make them over there.
They tried it out at the Lyric.
Yeah, I tried it out. And it was maybe the best Lucia I've ever seen. I mean, I obviously didn't see Maria Callas doing it because I'm not old enough. I'm so young, everybody. But, I mean, I've seen a couple of Lucias, and it was fantastic. And, you know, I don't think she necessarily has the, you know, the metal in the middle of her voice to carry off some of that music, but she certainly makes up for it with her acting, and I'm a very big fan of Natalie Dessay, and yeah, that's what I have to say about that.
I have to say, I think the inadvertent point of this article was great acting in opera makes up for, you know, ordinary singing. Because at the very end, the last couple of paragraphs, he says, champions of opera who insist on sublime voices, even at the expense of theatrical plausibility, may wonder what would become of, say, a new Montserrat Caballé were such a performer to emerge today. Miss Caballé, a brilliantly gifted soprano, was not known for her tiny waistline or for the depth expressiveness and physical daring of her performing style on stage. But, Mr. Gelb insisted with a laugh, she would be on stage of the Met. I'm not turning away Montserrat Caballé or Pavarotti. A voice like that is artistry itself. Mm-hmm. So, like, the indirect message was, if you've got a great voice, it still doesn't matter whether you can act or not. That if you're just sort of, you know, workaday singer, in order to make it big, you do have to have that extra dramatic capability. Bit, yeah.
But I agree with that 100%. Don't you? I mean, don't you, Michael?
No. I mean, there's something to be said for that, I guess. It seems maybe that he was afraid of getting some kind of like fat discrimination by bringing out Caballé and Pavarotti Gelb mm-hmm. with this. I really don't know where I, to be honest, I don't know where I stand on this. I kind of go back and forth with this all the time. I certainly think that I enjoy a performance more if I enjoy both the singing and I enjoy and I believe and understand and find some agreement with what's happening on stage. It doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't have to be Olivier. You know, there's no way Domingo could act, you know, Othello the way that Olivier is able to act Othello, because it would kill you, because he's got to sing through it. So obviously it's not apples and oranges, but it's, you know, apples and like Braeburns and Granny Smiths. You know, you can't.
Fascinating.
It's close enough, but at the same time, there's got to be, you've got to have a little bit of both, I think. I personally, my personal taste is that way, because I do think that it is music, but it's also theater, because if you're going to put it on stage, there's no point. You can easily do it in an opera house, but just have people stand around and sing. And certainly you can emote with the voice, and you can act with your voice, and you can declaim, and this is actually going to go on to something later on we're talking about it. You can declaim the text, and you can be involved without doing a lot. I'm not saying that you have to be running around and, you know, furrowing your brow and falling on the floor, but I like to have both, personally.
But wouldn't you say, like, where opera is moving and the more contemporary opera pieces and where we are in time and bringing in audiences, it is more crucial to have acting singers as opposed to the Park and Bark standard? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think a lot of that is gone. That nobody.
Well, I mean, I don't know, because I remember recently I saw a tenor, and I won't say who, but a very famous tenor.
Say it.
No, I can't. But it's a very famous tenor who I personally don't like that much. But I just remember I watched him in a Werther, and he got up and he sang, and he had this incredibly huge voice, and he's an incredibly famous tenor. But every time he sang, he'd step away, you know, from Charlotte. He'd step away and just do his little number, and then he'd step back into the scene. And after the first, like, 30 minutes of the show, I didn't care how beautiful he sang. I just wanted to get up from my seat and leave. Because to me, there was no commitment to the character. There was no interaction with the other people on stage. It was just all about his voice, and that's just not interesting. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I completely agree.
Are you sure he wasn't a blind tenor?
No.
Was he physically fit? Did he like to swim in Speedos and stand on his head outside of his villa?
God. I don't know. I can't say who.
Well, this has to do with something that I talk about a lot, or I have at least in the recent podcast, that in the big theaters like the Met and our little theater we have here in Chicago, the Lyric Opera, the theaters are just so big that actually subtle acting, it's hard to appreciate, you know? And in a way, you kind of need these big voices to fill up the space and to, you know, to carry the drama. And I do think that you can, of course, be a good actor and have a big voice, but I think that where people are going to have a moving experience is going to be in a smaller house, you know? And there is where, you know, smaller voices and maybe better actors can thrive, you know? And then now we have TV. We have all these video, you know, broadcasts, and who knows what that's going to do to the Met, like, because now, you know, if they're going to start broadcasting all of these operas, you know, I'm really curious to see how small the voices are going to get.
Yeah.
Well, it's true that a lot of these operas weren't conceived with enormous houses in mind, so.
Yeah, maybe the golden era went away from the whole point of opera in some ways. As far as the venues that they're performing, we think of the golden era of, you know, the 40s and the 50s and all these, you know, gargantuanly voiced singers. But, you know, that wasn't the intention.
That's why they need these big screens on either side, to like in sporting events where you have the
So I can catch the play-by-play, and I can find out who's going to win. You know, the red car, the green car, or the yellow car during the seventh inning stretch or the halftime, or the intermission.
And you can see what action is going on in other opera houses across
Chicago.
The nation.
Over in Chicago, we've got Rodolfo. Looks like he's going to be breaking up with Mimi. Let's see what's going on over there in Trovatore down in Boston. Uh-oh. It looks like his mother's stolen. He's pretty pissed off. He's apparently just standing still, though, and singing for about 5 minutes to the audience instead of going after his mother. We'll get back to him in a little bit with that.
Exactly what I had in mind.
Yeah, I hope so. Well,
opera kind of lives or dies by its singing, but it's always better when the acting is good.
It is better when there's both.
Yeah.
Because it's theater. It is theater.
It's a kind of theater. Go into a recording studio. If you can't act and you can't be a character, just go record.
Like McCormack, go to the recital stage.
Yeah, you know.
John McCormack, a great voice, and he knew that he was a schlump up on stage, so
he decided
to do recitals instead.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really of the school of, like, I personally, this is my own viewpoint, I personally would rather see a committed, passionate performer, passionate actor, whose voice sometimes, you know, gives in to the emotion and isn't always perfectly in place, than somebody who has this incredible instrument, but yet doesn't give... Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I just would prefer to see the actor who's giving everything to the character. That's just me, though.
Well, Aaron, if you listen to our very first podcast, you would already know that the recording industry is dead.
Yeah, no, I know.
Okay. It's true.
It's true.
Let's move on. Here's a little quick thing. Don't Rock the Boat, opera in progress. Rock the boat, baby. In its 15-year history, American stevedoring has moved hundreds of thousands of televisions, loaded tons and tons of caffeine, shipped and received everything from sofas to ambulances. Now it's hauling its most precious cargo yet, dinners. A 69-year-old former oil tanker, moored in the company's container in Red Hook, Brooklyn, has been transformed into the set for Il Tabarro by Puccini. For more than 2 months, dozens of singers, actors, and crew members have been commuting to Pier 9B and the Buttermilk Channel to rehearse. The one-act show, a romantic thriller about a longshoreman and his philandering wife, was scheduled to open last night and will continue tomorrow and next weekend. So, for those of you who don't know this opera, Tabarro takes place on the river in Paris, and as we've said, it's a longshoreman on a boat, and they've put it onto a boat in the harbor in Brooklyn.
It's not actually in Paris, is it? Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look that up.
It is in Paris, yes. I believe.
We'll have our viewers.
That's irregardless.
Anyway.
So this is interesting. They're putting it on the boat. That's pretty sweet.
It sounds very OC, doesn't it?
It does sound very OC. Yeah. And actually, very Long Beach Opera. I met the guy who runs that company. I forget his name now. And he did a production of an operatic production of Anne Frank. The Diary of Anne Frank, and he did the performance. It's not like he said it. The performance was done in a parking garage, and the audience was sitting in a parking garage watching it. His big thing was that, you know, the environment in which the audience sees a performance is just as important as what is going on stage. So that sounded pretty far out.
So this happened last year, or this is happening right now?
It's going on right now.
Okay, I wonder how the audience turnout is for that, and what the audience thinks about it. I'm curious about the acoustics. It says the acoustics are good. But I'm wondering about the success of an opera by a famous composer without a famous aria, you know? Like, Il Tabarro is probably the weakest of the Tridico, you know? And so if they can stage that by itself and...
What about Hai ben ragione? Hai ben ragione!
No, I don't know that one, so...
It's the tenor aria. There's two great... The baritones and his aria are very good. The tenor's aria.
Okay, it is in Paris, but I was thinking of Rouen because
you're
Michele refuses to take Luigi to Rouen.
Yes.
So I'd like to apologize for that location error.
We were all waiting with bated breath.
Yeah, I know.
So.
Well, what's next? Sewer Angelica in a convent?
Why not?
Could be.
God bless it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No one would come, but... Okay.
What is the name of the company doing this? It doesn't seem to say. The Vertical Rep. What the hell is that? Oh, well.
Yeah.
But this sounds, it sounds like a cool idea. There's a pretty cool picture of Judith Barnes is playing Georgetta, and Christian Siebeck is the tenor. I forget the tenor's name. Luigi. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's Brooklyn Opera Company. I'm sorry. Brooklyn Opera Company.
Oh.
I didn't know that, though.
It's only, what, an hour long, that piece, or not even an hour?
No, it's the Vertical Player Repertory.
I'm talking about El Tesoro.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's very short. It's a great opera, though. Wonderful opera. Mm-hmm.
It's the best really one of the...
I wonder how they fill out the
I think
bill.
It's the best of the three.
Yeah.
I wonder what they do to make it a complete evening for their audience.
I don't know. Maybe they show On the Waterfront beforehand.
Listeners should go get the Delmonico recording.
That's a great recording with Tibaldi and Robert Merrill.
Yeah.
It's the whole Tridico you can get, I think, too.
That's true.
Yeah. Great, great opera. The opening is fantastic. You can hear the waves. You can hear the gentle flowing of the river in the orchestration. Don't rock the boat, baby. Opera in progress. If this boat's rocking, don't come knocking, baby. So now, let's see what else is going on. Oh, yeah. Opera Singers by Condo. This is an old story that was in the old show, but it was funny. I get links of like opera-related news all the time, and it sends me alerts. And apparently, two opera singers bought a condo in Chicago, and it made some kind of paper. So that's great. Good luck to them, Mr. Embry and Miss Bunnell, or Bunnell.
Jane Bunnell, yeah.
Jane Bunnell. So, opera singers buy condo. Who says you can't make a living in this business?
That's it.
Okay.
There's the
proof. This is newsworthy.
It is, apparently so. It made my Google alert. Let's see, what else is... Oh, we're coming on to... Guess who died?
No.
First of all, I just found out today, Jane Wyman died.
Who?
Jane Wyman, of course, former wife of President Ronald Reagan, first wife of Ronald Reagan.
And star on, what was that TV show?
Falcon Crest.
With Lorenzo
Lama and Robert Foxworthy. Great show about a winery, a wine family in California. Kind of like on par with something like Dynasty in Dallas. A great nighttime soap opera.
Dynasty.
It was hot stuff, too. Very hot stuff. Jane Wyman. No, she wasn't actually very hot on it. But yeah, former could have been First Lady and also ran. Great actress. So, rest in peace.
She won an Oscar back in the day.
She did?
Did she?
I believe it was in 1948.
What was it for?
I don't know. Look it up.
Okay. You remember the year, but not the performance?
I was reading about it.
Okay. Let's see. What else? Who else died? Oh, Luciano Pavarotti.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Rose Bampton.
No. I skipped over Rose Bampton.
Jerk.
The big Lucci. The big man.
Didn't I call in the last podcast?
That he was going to die?
The very end of the last podcast that's right now, that's online, episode 27.
Possibly. I don't recall.
Yeah, I called it.
Wow.
Wow, what a bold prediction. He had terminal cancer.
Yeah. And lived really long for having pancreatic cancer.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Man, I mean, I mentioned, you know, many, many episodes ago that this would be the Guess Who Died of Guess Who Dieds, but he's gone, man. Big Luciano has gone, reads a banner headline on the website of the news agency ANSA in reference to the nickname by which he was affectionately known in Modena. Man, I don't know what to say.
Well, I will say that the media certainly covered this story. I mean, Beverly Sills died, and yeah, that got a lot of noise. But you know, this was on everything. I mean, this was even on like the local news. You know, and
he was huge. I mean,
he was an order of magnitude bigger than Beverly Sills.
Yeah,
I mean, he was known for also combining so much with popular, you know, music singers like Bono, or you know, he brought it to the general public.
But I think he could have died 15 years ago, and it would have been much the same.
Of course.
Sure.
Well, or maybe when the three tenors first came out.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
Yeah. Couple things that I want to discuss about him. It seems obviously it got a lot of coverage, and they talked about how beloved he was and how he opened up opera to the world, and I want to get into that in a little bit. But the thing that surprised me was there are two articles that I read, one in Opera News Online and one in the Wall Street Journal. This was on September 8th, and I believe he passed away on, was it Friday or Thursday? I can't recall off the top of my head.
I think it was Thursday, yeah, but so I can't remember anymore.
This is, you know, this weekend, you know, 2 days, a day after he passed away. How Will Luciano, when he Was Good by Terry Teachout. That's what a name. How will Luciano Pavarotti be remembered? If you saw him on stage in the last decade of his life, you saw a self-parody of a great singer gone to seed. Now, this Luciano Pavarotti is, I think, and I don't think I'm alone, one of the great voices of this era, and I think of the century. Certainly one of the great tenor voices. The first sentence that this SOB comes out with, people are giving, it's a hatchet job on him. The guy just passed away 2 days ago. There was never anybody bigger in this business or anybody who deserved it more just because of the great talent that he had. And automatically, the first thing that are coming out of the... And Opera News was the same way. These people are starting to question his career and question his... This is insane.
He was a controversial guy for a lot of people. I mean, he was a person that some people loved to hate. I mean, not everyone, obviously, but there were a lot of people out there who just were offended in some way by him for whatever reason. Or felt, maybe they felt that... I think it's sort of a backlash against what they perceived as too much hype around one guy, you know. And, you know, you see that happen with people who are so famous and so unquestionably good.
You can say that there's, maybe they could complain about the crossover hype and all that. But the thing is, he had the goods to back it up.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like that he brought opera to the world and to people who wouldn't have heard an operatic singer before or listened to an aria or seen an opera even. But it's not like it was Andrea Bocelli doing it. This is a guy who had the goods.
But I remember, though, I mean, even, like, I'm talking like 15 years ago, I remember listening to people or arguing with people, you know, before a lot of the circus stuff started, who were just offended that he was considered as good as he was. And I could never personally understand it. But they would, you know, I would hear things like, he has an ugly voice, he's terrible, he's so overrated, blah, blah, blah. I would hear people say it.
Musicians or?
Yeah, I mean, people that are into... I mean, they were out there, you know, and I never could quite figure it out.
Voice.
I don't know, but they would say, like, his high C is so ugly.
Oh, God, that makes me want to vomit.
But I would listen to these people, and I couldn't, I mean, did you ever hear him? I mean, I don't know. I think they were just, they wanted to be, like, just to come across as, you know, more of an aficionado, you know. So as soon as you brought up Pavarotti, they would bring up tenors from the past who were better than him, which they may have been, but
or may
it was
not
like
have
this.
Been. Or he may
it
have
was like this one-upmanship. That, you know, it was like, well, Pavarotti, everybody thinks he's so great, but I know better.
Oh my God!
And I apparently that some of that still comes to the surface now, right after he dies.
Oliver, you've been kind of quiet.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm kind of of two minds about it. I mean, I grew up in the '80s, and I only got to see that Pavarotti with the handkerchief and the sweat and, you know, the concerts of Neapolitan songs. And, you know, I wasn't such a fan when I was first introduced to him. But then, you know, delving deeper into opera and, you know, becoming a recordings aficionado, I exposed myself to his better moments, you know, and it's hard to find.
You should never expose yourself to anybody.
It's not so easy to find, actually, you know.
His better moments?
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that if you were to walk into a record store at age, you know, whatever, 19, like a freshman in college, and not know what you were doing, you would see Pavarotti and Friends, and, you know, Pavarotti sings with Vanessa Williams and stuff like that, and you would say, what's the big deal about this guy, you know? And it's not until you get to, like, you know, recording of Rigoletto or, like, you know...
Bohème. The 72 Bohème
or something like that, yeah. That you realize, oh, that's what this guy's about, you know. And I have to say that I was given a recording of that Bohème as a gift by somebody, one of my professors from Northwestern, And it remains my favorite Boehm recording.
It is.
I mean, Franny is on there. And...
See, I guess I was maybe fortunate because that was my father was interested in opera and he had a lot of recordings. And one of the first record, I think probably the first opera recording I ever listened to was that La Boheme record, the Decca London label Boheme, with Carrion conducting and
Franny.
Pavarotti, yeah. Franny, Panerai, Giarov, who was also a huge influence to me as a singer, and that was the first introduction really I had to and Pavarotti because he also my father had a lot of other Pavarotti recordings, and he was the first introduction I ever had to operatic singing, and it's you know I don't think there's anyone. He was so his voice was amazing. It was beautiful. It was, but it was so well produced, and it was so. I mean, as I mentioned before, there was nobody better at really declaiming the text. I don't think than Pavarotti. It became a natural extension of speaking, and ironically enough, you know, people would say that he was this big lug on stage, and he was, you know, he wasn't an actor by any means, but. Everything he sang, it was so natural. It was as if you were having a conversation, or as if he was having a conversation with people. If you listen to the aria from Boheme, the Che gieli da manina, it is the opening line especially. It is so natural and speech-like. It is, in my mind, maybe I'm going against myself. But as I said, I kind of go back and forth on things. How much more acting do you need than that?
Yeah.
It's like he's talking to somebody and like he's just having a conversation with them and the text is coming out naturally and it's clear. Nobody had better diction than Pavarotti. Nobody.
That's true. You could take notation from his diction.
You could. You really, really could.
Yeah.
His voice was just so amazing and so thrilling. I actually had a chance to listen to, he certainly became famous the world over with his appearance. I think it was in 72 at the Met in the Daughter of the Regiment, where, of course, that aria, he's got, you know, the 8 high Cs or the 9 high Cs. And I listened to a bootleg of it recently, and it's unbelievable. It's absolutely – and I was thinking – I was getting, like, goosebumps waiting for that scene to – waiting for the second half of the aria to begin, thinking that this was that moment that everybody went crazy for, and that he just gets this huge ovation. And it sounds unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable.
Sure. No, he has the most beautiful abal of, I think, any tenor on record.
Except McCormick.
Okay.
Well, possibly. And he would have said that, too. He was a big fan of Jean McCormick's.
Well, you brought up diction. I was just thinking of McCormick just now because you had mentioned him a minute ago. And another guy who had phenomenal diction.
That's very true. Yeah,
and Pavarotti admired him and tried to emulate him. So.
Yeah. No, I think that you know his recorded legacy is formidable, and I wish we can get rid of some of those recordings too, and just get you know present to you know the young audience or the future opera fans what is essential Pavarotti. Can we do that right now? Like, what is essential Pavarotti for those people who don't know? And I'll put in my two votes.
Give us top three.
Okay,
Oliver, we'll have you go first.
Okay, Boheme is already, we talked about that, so that's obviously one of my
That's
top
the
three.
Boheme, the Carrion Boheme on
yes.
London.
The Un ballo in maschera, the recording with Schulte and Margaret Price.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because this is the point, I think, in his, you know, in his own singing where the older sound comes in, like where the voice is darkening a little bit, but there are moments, of course, where the voice is just so open and there's just a joy in the sound. And this is exactly that character of Ricardo. It's like a young leader who is, you know, faced with like these, you know, with the conspiracists and, you know,
a dark
with his
future
own...
and problems and everything.
Exactly. Yeah. And just the chiaroscuro of the character is perfectly reflected in his voice. The other recording that I absolutely adore is the second Rigoletto, not the first one that's very famous with
Anderson one and Shai.
Yeah, June Anderson and Leonucci, recorded by Shai. Conducted by Shaley. Everybody talks about the first one as being, you know, oh, he's so young and he's so fresh and stuff like that. But personally, I think Joan Sutherland kind of mars the recording a little bit, like, because she's so goofy sounding in those ambient roles, you know? I mean, I love her. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think she's one of the most amazing singers ever. But she just doesn't sound young and innocent or anything like that, you know? She always sounds matronly. So the June Anderson recording, I mean, we could talk about June Anderson for another podcast because I love her. But in this second recording, once again, he's older. I think even older than... I think it was recorded...
It was after the Balo.
Yeah, it was in the 90s that he recorded that. And there's this kind of, I guess, a little bit ugliness, for lack of a better word, that has crept into his voice. This kind of lecherous, sweaty quality that, you know, that he kind of looked like too, you know. That is so that character, is so the Duke. It's like, yeah,
with
you know.
Dyed beard, freshly dyed beard.
Yeah. You know, he's a passionate person. But he also is driven by sex, you know, in this opera. And I think, you know, what happened? What did Papa do? He dumped his wife of 35 years and went for somebody 30 years younger than him, you know. So,
yeah, I agree that the first Rigoletto, he sort of sounds like Rodolfo instead of the Duke, you know. So, it's amazing singing though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Brian,
I would throw in the Rossini Stabat Mater.
Yeah.
That's a great... I forget the conductor, damn it. It's on my shelf, but that's the end of the room. He has a great high D-flat in that. Anything you can get him singing above high C is always interesting. Maybe it's a D. Is it a D-flat? Anyone?
D-flat,
it's D-flat. It's C-sharp, actually, I think.
See, whatever.
And harmonically equal.
True.
Any other... You got a couple...
And Neapolitan songs, you know. His recital stuff was amazing. Mm-hmm. Aaron.
Yes.
You got a couple favorites.
How are you doing there?
No, I'm completely in agreement with everything y'all just said, so I have nothing.
Any plums you want to put in there of Johnny Pavarotti?
No, I'm actually looking at this article and just feeling sick to my stomach. I think it's just such a disgrace.
It's a hatchet job.
It's a disgrace. I mean, this is an icon of opera.
The Terry Teach out Wall Street Journal.
Oh, okay. My God. And it's the whole opening paragraph. I mean... I just don't understand how they can do that to somebody like him, you know?
Because he's a critic, and he thinks he has to,
for argument's sake.
Sibelius said, man, that nobody ever, you know, there's no statue of a critic anywhere, so he was right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the guy, the Mr. Teachout.
I haven't given my choices.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
Go ahead.
Don't worry about it. I do like his, there's a Tosca that he has. Franny's she's okay, but he's pretty good on it.
Oh, he's amazing on that recording.
Yeah, with Milnes.
Oh yeah,
it's like
I forgot.
Buschino or something conducting, and I've got an autograph by Cheryl Milnes. It's pretty sweet. this was a great session. let me think. There's a couple other ones I had in mind, but now I'm blanking on them.
Did you record the Fedora with Fedora?
I don't know if he recorded Fedora with Franny. I don't think so. Oh, the butterfly that he did is very good as well with Franny. Her first one, not the one she did later with Carreras, obviously. And
you know what else is fun? If you're speaking of Carrion, go back and listen to Carrion's Rosenkavalier.
Oh, with him as the Italian singer?
From like the late 60s, I think, where he's the Italian singer. And it doesn't really sound like the same Pavarotti. It's an interesting early recording.
It's all great.
Well, do we dare talk about, you know, the things we know of about Pavarotti, like how he couldn't read music and how he behaved, you know, backstage or on stage and stuff like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he couldn't read music, and, you know, that's true. Franny can't read music.
Yeah.
Ezio Pinza couldn't read music. But you can't deny that these people all had, when they were on stage performing and singing, they had an inherent musicality that...
The Beatles couldn't read music either.
So, and Paul McCartney wrote a freaking oratorio, such as it was, but, you know, just because you can't read music and you can't conduct an orchestra or, you know, condense a full score to piano, it doesn't mean you're not a musician.
It's true.
That's what I think. I mean, he certainly nothing he ever... Most of the time, the things that he did... When he obviously sometimes maybe he was less prepared. Okay, that's fine. I can understand that. But
music is about the ear.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
But what is this? Tell me the stories of this backstage behavior and et cetera.
Well, I mean, he was fired
a lot of food
from Lyric Opera.
He would cancel all the time. That's why.
Yeah.
He canceled a lot.
supposedly he liked to stash food like on stage, and he would be eating during performances.
Sorry,
that's what I heard.
Oh, come on.
That's what
hungry.
I heard.
He's hungry.
Yeah.
If he wants to hide a provolone.
You got to feed the machine.
Yeah, the thing. That's and on a side note, for anybody out there who's ever watched SCTV, the show that was based out of Canada, they did a parody of The Godfather. The whole point of the show, SCTV, was that it was this kind of like second or third rate television station. And, you know, they had this cast of characters who were regulars, who were the owner and the manager, et cetera, and like stars on the show. And they did this parody of The Godfather with, you know, the station owner. His daughter was getting married, and he was going to be taking on the heads of the five networks. But they had this opening scene where his daughter's getting married, and instead of, if you've seen The Godfather, when, you know, Johnny Fontaine, the Italian singer, comes to the daughter's wedding, in this it was Johnny Pavarotti, and it was played by John Candy. He did a great Luciano Pavarotti. And, yeah, it was pretty funny.
And I wonder if you can find that on YouTube. And
It's on YouTube. I will put the link up there.
Okay.
He's gnawing on a provolone. And so. Oh, and the Di Quella Pira, that recording. The Trovatore recording. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot that.
And the Daughter of the Regiment recording is pretty good.
Yeah. So.
Wait a second. Start over again. Di Quella Pira is on the Bonning recording with Sutherland,
yes.
And Horn.
Yeah.
Well, you know those are like my favorite singers, but I think that recording is... You can't recommend that as a recording.
What about his recording of that aria?
Yeah. And then the other one you just said was Daughter of the Regiment. Once again, daughter of who? You know, like... Look at even the cover of that recording. She's Snowby's daughter. You know?
She's the mother of the regiment.
I know. She's the grandmother of the regiment.
Well, but it's just for him. We're talking about him. Yeah. We're not talking about the recordings.
Right. Okay.
It's P-Day, and it's not Petraeus. It's
right. Sutherland will die soon enough, and we can find good recordings of her. Don't worry.
So, I mean, other than recordings, did anyone or everyone here hear him live and not in a big stadium?
I heard him at the United Center eating nachos and drinking a beer.
Anybody hear him unmiked?
No.
Besides me?
Were you in that Otello project?
No, but I went to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that the thing you heard him the only time?
Yeah,
you heard him?
That's the only chance I got to hear him in a real... Never got to see him at the Met or anything, but I tell you, I mean, you know, you can talk about recordings all day, but the voice in person was, I think, the most impressive thing. It was like a light going on, you know. It was like he was instantly different from any singer on stage. I mean, and not that there were that many on stage for Otello, but it had a resonance that was lacking in his peers. And by all accounts, everybody, you know, would say that. I mean, he was more like the older singers in terms of the way his voice would carry and fill a room and. Mm-hmm.
It was essentially a lyrical voice, a lyric tenor voice.
Yeah, but those are the voices that always like mop up the stage if
that's
they're
what I'm
done
saying.
Right.
It was just the size. It was a very sizable instrument. I'm talking about like the timbre, and you know what I mean. And that's how he was able to move into heavier roles, like you know Radames and some of the heavier Verdi roles, you know Manrico and Trovatore. Just because, despite whatever the timbre of it was a sizable instrument that was well produced.
Mm-hmm.
Most importantly, so it would carry. It would easily carry.
But it wasn't a sizable instrument compared to, like, a Richard Tucker, you know, according to people who've heard both. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a dramatic tenor size.
No.
And there's no one, like...
It would carry, that's what I mean.
Yeah, and a good lyric tenor should carry like Pavarotti did, instead of, like, a lot of modern lyric tenors who are harder to hear, you know. I don't know, that's my ideal for a lyric tenor voice, is that kind of Pavarotti McCormick sound, I think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great live, and you know, over a full orchestra of the Chicago Symphony, he had absolutely no problem.
In one of the hardest
burying them, basically.
Ever written for the tenor voice. So.
Yeah, and singing a role that he shouldn't have been singing.
Yeah. And I did hear from people that were in the chorus that night that he has a kind of a special score that he uses, like where there's like arrows and pointing up, and like he has all these like cartoon images that like remind him of how the music goes and stuff like that. Like almost as complicated a system as actual music notation without actually reading music
notation. Well, it was a role he had to work really hard to prepare because he wasn't you know, he wasn't an Otello, and Schulte talked him into it because he, you know, he thought he would sound better than anybody else.
Yeah, Schulte, there's a story of Schulte saying, well, who else is going to sing? I mean, today, like, what other voice would you put in it, you know?
Otello.
I actually think that's in the liner notes of the recording. There might be a little note from him.
Schulte shrugs. Who else like, are you going to get?
What are you going to do?
But yeah, it was amazing when he came when he came in with the Esultate. It was just like, oh wow, you know, really thrilling. I'd never heard a voice fill orchestra hall like that, you know. And I heard a lot of singers.
I've never heard the recording. Do you have it?
I don't, but I've listened to it, and it's, you know, it's pretty damn good. I mean, I think he's miscast with, you know, the likes of Leonucci. But, you know, nothing against Leonucci.
Kiwi is on the record, isn't she?
Kiri Takano, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, hearing him live was really special. And the other thing is, like, when the three tenors came out, I hate to keep blabbing on, but it was so funny to me that I thought that was, like, a really risky thing at the time for Domingo and Carreras. And I guess it was because, I guess they were fine because it was, like, these stadium concerts with mics. But it just, that recording just made it so obvious to me who was the superior. I mean, I just thought he sounded head and shoulders better than either of them. Like, when they would sing trios, he would come in and it was like, oh, well, there's the good one, you know? That was just how I reacted to it. Mm-hmm. But everybody, and instead there was this big debate, like, who's the best of the three tenors? You know, who has the best voice? They're all different. And
yeah, they're just also incredibly different to me.
They are, but every time he would come in, it was like, oh, that's the real thing, and the others are just sort of trying to do that. You know, it was just easier for him.
Sure.
Well, I really think that Carreras was, I don't know what happened, whether it's illness or he was doing things he shouldn't have. You know, back in, you know, early 80s, late 70s, I thought he was phenomenal. There's a great recording of Carreras of Tosca with Caballé and Ingvar Wixel, who's kind of leaves something to be desired to Scarpia. But Carreras is fantastic in that recording. It's like the E Luceva in la Stelle. It's just, it's absolutely amazing, the aria. As he goes towards the end, the height, it's unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, who can say what happened to his voice?
Well,
and what the
Carreras is really sick, isn't he?
Well, he was.
He had leukemia. Leukemia. Yeah.
Right.
But you know, and I don't know what the reasons were. Because he had a great voice, I'm saying. I think he was fantastic. But I do tend to agree with you, though, Brian, that certainly between Domingo and Pavarotti, I'm going to take Pavarotti, personally.
Well, and having heard them both live, there was really no comparison.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, I heard them both in Orchestra Hall, and I've heard Domingo at Lyric, and Pavarotti, you know, was a much louder voice, and much, I mean, if you're just talking about the impressiveness of the sound, I mean, Domingo is a great artist in his own right, so I'm not
Domingo has a lot of different colors, I find. I mean, I don't know, I'm a big, huge Pavarotti fan, don't get me wrong, but I also appreciate Domingo because he's got so many beautiful colors and kind of warmth, more warmth to the voice, often. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. But just, I mean, in terms of, I kind of obsess about technique and vocal production, and there was just something, it was so clear that Pavarotti was doing something differently, you know.
He's just more natural. I mean,
he was just lighting up the room in a way that Domingo could not imitate.
Sure.
So, at least not Domingo at the time I heard him. Maybe in the 70s it was a different story. You know, so. I mean, Domingo's voice also sort of, you know, didn't hold up to what it was at first, I think. Kind of like Carreras. So,
but he's still, he's doing something right. He's still
doing something right.
No, I mean, he obviously knows what he's doing. And I'm not saying.
I think it's unfair to compare these three on that concert. I mean, they put themselves up for comparison by singing the concert together, but, you know, Pavarotti's technique and his natural gifts just are so much more obvious than, you know, the ailing Carreras and the aging Domingo, you know. I do think that Carreras of the three is the most exciting of the singers, but, you know, he did a lot to hurt his own voice by pushing the top and by trying to stretch, you know, the dramatic potential of his sound. And Domingo, for my money, is just, I don't know. I mean, I've never been entirely moved by his singing. I mean, like, it's beautiful, but like whenever it gets near the top, it makes me on edge. You know, I'm always worried about how the voice is going to lose its it's colored and it's going to get kind of metallic sounding.
Is this recent?
That shows great sensitivity that you're worried, though.
So, yeah.
It shows you're very caring.
Domingo really had to struggle for his high notes, and they were like the last to come and the first to go.
Yeah.
With him, you know. I mean, he had a few years of career without anything above much of an A flat, I think, and then he finally figured out something, and then, you know, it was kind of ephemeral, I think, for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, squeezing out a B flat on a good day was a good day for him.
Well, see, another thing I think that a lot of people talked about what a naturally beautiful voice Pavarotti had and how it was blessed by God. But there's something, I mean, the thing that I love so much about his, one of the things that I love so much about his voice, and that is something that he worked at, you know, either with his teacher or on his own, is his approach to the passaggio. And that's something that you're not going to be blessed with a beautiful passaggio. It's something that you make a conscious effort to work at, and
right.
Didn't
that was one of his strongest features, I think. The strongest features of his voice is the way he approached the passaggio and the transition upward, you know, from the chest up into the higher so-called head registers of the tenor voice, that made it oftentimes very seamless, and the vowels were never too distorted, and, you know, like a lot of tenors' voices were. Personally.
Well, for technical wonks out there, I mean, I think his idea was you had to sing your vowels the same size on either side of the passaggio, so that there wasn't this big stretch, and, you know, he wanted to tighten everything up and sing on an oo as much as he could, and I think that's what gave him the evenness, at least as he explained it. I mean, can we talk about this for a second, this idea of whether he was a natural talent or a developed talent? Because I think it's really interesting. Especially for, you know, maybe young singers who assume. I mean, I always heard in college that, you know, don't try to be another Pavarotti. You know, there's the Pavarottis of the world, and then there's everybody else. And then when I started to learn more about it, I mean, the thing is, he wasn't a Pavarotti at first. You know, people who heard him in the late '60s, you know, he wasn't the same voice then that he became when he hit his peak. He was a smaller voice from what I heard, and, you know, not as easy. And then he famously did that gig with Joan Sutherland, as he would tell it, and they toured Australia and whatnot, and she taught him how to breathe, you know, how to do this what we call a poggio, and to really use his body when he sang and less of his throat. So he probably had a voice that was really well lined up, but it didn't have that massive strength underneath it that a real opera singer has to have, and he got that. And then it really bloomed and became a large, large sound. So that's not a natural talent issue. That's a thing that he really worked at. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember.
Right. I think personally, of course, he had a huge heads up on the, you know, the biggest thing about him is the language, using the language, etc. I mean, he's a native, you know, Italianate singer, so that's a big heads up right there.
With a singer for a father too.
Yeah. Exactly.
But even still, there are Italian singers who you can't necessarily understand what they're saying, and not, you know, it's the same way you know, English singers who you can't understand what they're singing all the time when they're like George London, say, for example. I mean, nothing against him, but Christ, when he would sing in English, it was like, what the? It's like diphthong. You couldn't understand anything that he said. It was awful, absolutely awful. So here's a guy that it's so clean and so easily produced that it's refreshing. You never hear that. I've never heard anybody with diction that good, personally, that was so clear and easy to understand.
Didn't he and Mara Lefrani study with the same voice teacher or something?
I know they had the same wet nurse.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Had the same teacher, too.
That was some sweet milk, man. Get me a cup of that and call me in the morning.
Good Lord.
Nah, baby. So, well, I think I've enjoyed this edition of Pavarotti Talk. And we've really lost a giant, literally and figuratively.
God. Tacky.
He was, he wouldn't mind. He doesn't listen. He never listened to it when he was alive. He's not going to listen to it now that he's gone. What is this internet? Pass me a sandwich.
Podcast.
A podcast there. Nice shadow at the end. We've lost a giant. So, truly, he will be sorely missed. So that was, guess who died? How about that effortless high C? You guys like that?
That was
guess who died?
And just to sum it up real quick, I mean, you can say a lot of...
No, that summed it up. My guess who died.
Come on.
No, go ahead.
I just want to say, I mean, you can say a lot of bad things about the guy and mistakes and whatnot, but I just wish people would avoid the temptation to feel the need to have that take away from what he did do. It's like, just because you do something like sing on stage with Sting or whoever.
Sting's great. What's wrong with Sting?
I love Sting.
What's wrong with Elton John? These are all great people. It's not like he was on stage with Britney Spears or with...
He was on stage with the Spice Girls, though.
That sucks.
Yeah. Well, Sting's kind of a dick. But anyway, you can do that, but that doesn't mean it has to take away from what you did do that was more, you know, noble and historically noteworthy. And, you know, so just back off, people.
Yeah. And more importantly, the person who was... I would rather have... If I'm going to have an ambassador into the world of popular culture, I couldn't find anybody... There's no way for me... You know, and if somebody's going to hear somebody like Pavarotti in a concert with Sting, they're going to be hearing a real voice. They're going to be hearing a real talent, a real artist. They're not hearing Il Divo. They're not hearing, Russell Watson or whatever the hell his name, or Pol Pot. You know, they're hearing the real deal. Somebody who's put the work in, somebody who is a singer and one of the greats of all time.
So, and who sang with the greats. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you know what's interesting? The people notice and can hear the difference.
They can. They really can.
So, take that. So.
Can I add?
Thank you for saying that.
I'd like to add something that was kind of upsetting to me. I forget what newspaper had it. It probably was New York Times, even though I'm a subscriber. They had this interactive feature in one of their articles devoted to Pavarotti that was like a multimedia thing online where you can click on this button to see who's the potential next successor to the throne. And it was like, you know, it was Salvatore Licita and Alanya and Villazone. And like, you know, they show pictures of them and like you can hear a little clip of them singing, you know. But why does anybody have to ascend the throne? Like, why does anybody have to like be the next Pavarotti? Let them be who they are, you know.
Plus, they're already past the point. They're already themselves. You know, it's not like they're 19 years old. And
it's the hugest disgrace. I remember also before the funeral, you know, watching a TV interview with Alanya, you know, talking about Pavarotti.
Was he wearing a Speedo?
I think so, yes. And one of the first things asked was, so, are you going to be the next Luciano Pavarotti? It's a disgrace. It's horrible.
The guy's not, he's 2 days dead.
But nobody can be the next him.
His body's still warm.
I know. It's such a big body, it takes a while to cool down.
Terrible.
So, God, yeah, this is crap. Everybody, I hate everybody. I really fucking do hate everybody.
Let's sleep on that note.
Yeah. So,
everybody.
Well, listen, I want to thank everybody for coming on today. I want to thank my man B-Mac.
Thanks for having me.
My man OC, Oliver Camacho.
Can I make a plug?
Of course.
Will everybody please go to IanHowellCountertenor.com, H-O-W-E-L-L, all one word, IanHowellCountertenor.com. He's doing something really neat. He's broadcasting a recital, a 30-minute recital with program notes and everything like that. This is one of the singers I sang with at Amherst this summer, and he's one of the next big things, I promise you. He's using the internet in a very clever way. So
is he the next Pavarotti?
The next countertenor Pavarotti, yes.
Okay. He's the next prepubescent Pavarotti.
Counterrotti? So, and I want to thank the lovely, the sultry, the dynamic redhead, fire
the moist,
and hopefully,
no, come on.
Hopefully now dry, Aaron Elizabeth Smith.
Thank you, it was fun.
Thanks for coming on. We hijacked Aaron fresh out of the bath to come onto the show. Who knew? And we can't get her camera to work. I was hoping it would, but she's probably dressed by now anyway. So
yes, I am.
But listen, everybody, I want to thank all you people out there listening. Thanks for listening to the show, of course. And check us out at our website, operanow.blogspot.com. If you have a comment, question, concern, criticism, email us at operanow@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at the Opera Now hotline, 206-424-3617. Leave us a message. we haven't gotten a message in a long time. And the first person to leave me a message is going to win a special prize for me. Leave me a message.
Where's my phone?
Can I dial that now?
Leave me a voicemail and leave me your email in the voicemail, and I'll send you a special gift. It's going to be very exciting. It really, really is. You've been listening to Opera Now. I'm your host, Michael Rice. We'll talk to you next week, baby. So long, suckers.
And go play some Pavarotti, people.
You know, we should always include the people, if they listen to the show via the blog, but they should comment on the episode. You can leave a comment by clicking on comments. And I read those all the time.
People comment on the show.
Yeah, it's mostly Brian McGillery comments.
That's true.
The last couple times it is. But
it's mostly him defending what he said the previous week.
But I really like reading those comments. I'm excited to see something mention my contributions to the show. Yes, it's out of vanity, but I like reading it.
Yes. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Who, me?
Aaron.
Oh, no problem.
Hope we didn't disrupt your evening.
No, not at all.
We did.
Not at all.
It's Monday.
That's true. Monday. Can't trust that day anyway.
It's too early.
You got a big day planned tomorrow?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
Sweet.
A whole lot of nothing. The coaching, that's it.
Nice. Who's your coaching with?
Bateser, Michael Bateser.
Oh, Bateser. Wonderful.
Yes. I love my Bateser.
He's great. Oh, that's fabulous.
Yes.
Oh, you have a nice chest. That's you, because you're Sicilian. That's what he would say to me.
Did you know that they're going to do this concert for Beverly Sills? I don't know if it already happened, but that tickets are free. So they're doing a tribute to Beverly Sills, and like the first 500 people like in line get tickets.
Where?
At the Met.
Oh wow!
Of course.
Yeah.
Why did you ask them?
Well, I'm just kind of bugging it.
What did Brian ask? I'm wondering.
Oh. I thought it might have been City Opera.
Oh, okay.
At Lincoln Center.
When is it happening? Do you know, Oliver? Or?
I don't know.
Anybody who's in New York, email us. Let us know what's going on with this.
Yeah. I read about it, I think, on Opera
Chick. Any of you New York opera queens, get back to us.
Opera Chick. And if Opera Chick, if you're listening, for the love of God, please come on the show.
I almost had her on, but I'm trying to do an opera online summit. I'm going to get Handlemania. I'm going to try to get La Checa, and I'm trying to get Ed from Premier Opera and Opera Chick on as well. I was very close to doing it, but a couple people had some things going on. So look for that soon, everybody. An online opera summit.
Yeah.
The greatest minds.
It's going to be sweet.
Opera.
Well, I think it'd be nice to hear these people hear them. You know, everybody's so used to just reading them.
Yeah.
Hear what they have to say. Hey, everybody! I'm Opera Chick.
Turns out Opera Chick is a man.
It turns out that she's squeaky voiced teen from The Simpsons. So,
okay. Well, I just finished baking a cake, and I'm now excited. I'm going to eat it.